Now let's move ahead and go on to the immunopathology section. For this chapter, there are three big areas we need to hit. The first are the hypersensitivity reactions, the second are the autoimmune diseases, and we'll finish up with the immunodeficiency diseases. So let's start off with the hypersensitivity reactions first. I want to remind you that there are four of them. The first three require an antibody. The last one does not. It's cell-mediated. Let's talk about type 1 first. The other name for this is the anaphylactic type. It's characterized by production of IgE. The IgE gets implanted on the surface of mast cells. Once that's occurred, the body is now primed. The next time you're exposed to the antigen will cause cross-linking to occur of the IgEs on the surface of the mast cells. When the cross-linking occurs, the mast cell becomes stimulated and it will release all its products, especially histamine. Also, I want you to remember, where are mast cells in the body mostly located? They're around blood vessels of the skin and also in the lungs. So most of the manifestation are going to occur in the lungs and the skin. Okay, let's look at some of the release chemical mediators that are released from mast cells. Histamine is a big one. It's going to cause the wheal and flare reaction, edema for various tissues. They're also going to release eosinophil chemotactic factor, which is going to cause eosinophils to come in and prolong the hypersensitivity reaction. They'll also produce a bunch of other factors, leukotriene B4 and neutrophil chemotactic factor, which again we'll call in neutrophils. Okay, last thing I want you to remember is what diseases fall into this category? Well, systemic anaphylactic reactions, like reactions to bee stings or reactions to drug, is a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. And localized reactions, such as food allergies, asthma, allergic rhinitis, those all fall into the type 1 category. Now let's move to the type 2 and the type 3. Students tend to get these two confused. Let's start with type 2 first. This is called the cytotoxic type. By definition, you're producing an antibody, either an IgM or an IgG, which is directed against a specific target, either a specific target cell or a specific target receptor in the body. Once the antibody has attached to the target, the cell will be injured by either complement or by cell-mediated cytotoxicity. Let's look at some examples. For the complement-dependent cytotoxicity, a great example is autoimmune hemolytic anemia. Your body's producing an autoantibody against your own red cells. It's attaching. Complement is being activated, and that lyses the cell. Antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity, a great example of this is pernicious anemia. These are usually occur in older male patients. They develop antibodies against their own parietal cells in the stomach. The antibody attaches to the cell. T cells will come in and will cause the cell to die or be lysed. Okay, so it's antibody dependent but cell mediated. The last one is called anti-receptor antibodies. This is where you've produced an antibody against a specific receptor. For instance, in Graves' disease, you've produced an autoantibody which attaches to the TSH receptor and stimulates it, leading to hyperthyroidism. Okay, let's contrast this with type 3 hypersensitivity. By definition, you've got to form immune complexes which circulate and deposit in tissues. Wherever in the body it deposits, you're going to get inflammation and disease. So let's look at some examples. In systemic lupus, that's a great example of a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. You're forming immune complexes, which are depositing in tissues, especially of the face, and you will develop a rash, a nice malar butterfly rash, characteristic of lupus. Many of the glomerulonephritides are also be type 3 reactions. Again, you're producing antibodies which are attaching to some antigen, forming an immune complex. The complex circulates around. It deposits in the kidney. The kidney becomes inflamed, and you develop a glomerulonephritis. Okay, the last type is called type 4 hypersensitivity, also known as cell-mediated or delayed hypersensitivity. By definition, no antibodies are required. This is a disease of sensitized T cells. Where will you see this occur? Well, you see it in any disease that causes granuloma formation. Granuloma formation, by definition, is type 4 hypersensitivity. What else? When your body is fighting a virus, that is also type 4 hypersensitivity. And the last one is when your body's fighting tumors. Again, those are cytotoxic T-cell mediated responses. Okay, now let's switch gears and move to autoimmune diseases. The 5-star autoimmune disease is systemic lupus. The board loves this. You will guarantee to have a question on this. By definition, it's a chronic systemic autoimmune disease. It's characterized by the loss of self-tolerance. You start to produce autoantibodies against your own body. You don't just produce one. You produce a whole gamut of autoantibodies against your DNA, against histones, RNA proteins, blood cells. Okay, so it's a whole gamut of autoimmune antibodies. Let's look at the epidemiology. Great generalization for the autoimmune diseases is they tend to be more common in females. So sure enough, lupus is about 9 times more common in females than males. It also tends to affect African Americans more commonly and more severely than Caucasians. Okay, for lupus, I want you to remember, what are some of the specific autoantibodies that are produced? Well, one of them is called ANA, anti-nuclear antibody. It's present in about 95% of patients, okay, but it is not specific. Okay, sensitive, but not specific. The specific ones are anti-double-stranded DNA and anti-Smith. Those are the two that are very, very specific for SLE. They've asked in the past, which is more sensitive, double-stranded or anti-Smith? The answer is double-stranded by far. Let's go on to the mechanism. These patients have a combination of type 2 and type 3 hypersensitivity. Look at the distribution of disease. The whole body can be affected. Very commonly, they'll have hemologic problems. They'll have hemolytic anemia, decreased platelet counts, neutropenia. They can develop arthritis due to the immune complexes deposited in joints. The skin, the famous butterfly rash, very characteristic on these patients. Remember, it's often induced because of sunlight. There's a photosensitivity component to it. Next, I want you to triple star is the kidney. The kidney is almost always involved in these patients because of these immune complexes. In your handout is the WHO classification for the kidneys. You do not need to know this in detail, but you do need to know at least class 5 and class 4. Class 4 is called diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis. It's the most common. It's also the most severe. That's why you need to know about it. The other one is class 5. It's called membranous. Okay, you're going to have the nephrotic syndrome. What's the famous lesion that occurs in the heart of these patients? It's called Liebman-Sachs endocarditis. These are huge vegetations that occur on either side of the valve. That's fairly unique. So they give you a heart valve, and you see vegetations on both sides. Think Liebman-Sachs, think SLE. Okay, let's talk about treatment. For most autoimmune diseases, steroids and immunosuppressive agents are the way to go. Prognosis, pretty unpredictable for lupus. They tend to have remissions and then relapses. 10-year survival is about 85%. Why do these patients die? Well, two reasons. They either die of renal failure or infections. Renal failure because of the kidney disease. Infections because, first of all, it's an autoimmune disease, so their immune system is not working properly. But also, how do you treat these patients? With steroids. Okay, let's move on to scleroderma. Progressive systemic sclerosis is the other name for this. With a name like that, you think there's going to be a lot of sclerosis in the body. Which cell is responsible for laying down collagen? It's the fibroblast. So this is an autoimmune disease characterized by fibroblast stimulation and deposition of collagen in different areas of the body. Let's take a look at the distribution. Again, tends to affect females more than males, usually in the Middle Ages. The pathogenesis, the fibroblasts are activated by cytokines, especially interleukin-1. Now, there are two major forms of scleroderma. There's the diffuse form, which is the more aggressive form, and there's the crest form, which is the localized form. Let's talk about the diffuse form first. You should know what is the autoantibody which is associated with this. It's called anti-DNA topoisomerase 1, also known as SCL70. SCL stands for scleroderma. Now, these patients tend to have widespread skin involvement. It tends to affect especially the hands. They can develop very, very taut, thick, sclerotic fingers, which actually start to contract, and they develop like claw-like hands. The other place that's typically involved is the face. The face becomes very thickened and smoothed out. Remember, scars contract, so the face contracts, and they start to lose all the wrinkle lines. Their face becomes smooth and mask-like. Now, the problem with the diffuse type is it also involves the internal organs, the visceral organs. The esophagus tends to be involved, so they have problems swallowing. The GI tract becomes involved. They start to have malabsorption. The feared areas of involvement are pulmonary fibrosis. They can become dyspneic. Cardiac fibrosis can lead to arrhythmias. And finally, kidney fibrosis. They can develop renal insufficiency and renal failure. Now let's contrast that with the localized type. It's also known as the CREST syndrome. You should know what CREST stands for. Calcinosis, Raynaud's, esophageal dysmotility, sclerodactyly, and telangiectasia. You should know the antibody. It's an anti-centromere antibody. Again, the skin tends to be involved, especially hands and face. But the good news about this form is it tends to go internally very late in the course, so it tends to be more benign. Okay, let's move to the immune deficiency syndromes. A couple that I've seen them ask about. The first is called X-linked agammaglobulinemia of Bruton. Boy, that's a mouthful. By definition, it's an inherited immunodeficiency of B cells. The B cells do not mature. What do B cells normally mature into? Plasma cells, which produce all your antibodies. So guess what? These patients do not have antibodies. As a result, they tend to get recurrent bacterial infections. Clinically, you should know that it tends to affect males because it's X-linked. They start to have infections beginning at 6 months of life. Why at 6 months? Because that's when the maternal antibodies start to wane. Common infections, they tend to develop sore throats, inner ear infections, bronchitis, and pneumonias. And it tends to be with pyogenic organisms like strep pneumococcus, staph aureus, and H. influenza. Let's move on to DeGeorge's syndrome. Board loves this one because they can test your embryology. What occurs in this disease is you have embryologic failure to develop the third and fourth pharyngeal pouch. Now, what organs develop from the third and fourth pharyngeal pouch? Well, those are the thymus, which is important for T cells, and also the parathyroid glands. So the classic presentation on the exam is they give you a kid who has a T cell deficiency and has recurrent infections with viral, parasitic, and fungal organisms. They also tend to have hypocalcemia and tetany because they lack the parathyroid glands. Okay, let's move on to severe combined immunodeficiency syndrome. I like to remember this one as the bubble boy syndrome. If you've ever seen that old movie with John Travolta in the 70s, he had this syndrome. And basically, for these kids to survive, they have to be in a sterile environment. So they actually encase them in a bubble so they don't have exposure to all the bacteria in the environment. And that was the whole premise of that movie. By definition, this is a combined immune deficiency. It knocks out your stem cells, so you have both B and T cell problems. Let's look at the modes of inheritance. It can be X-linked, or more commonly on the exam, they ask about autosomal recessive. Why? Because in the autosomal recessive, there's a deficiency in adenosine deaminase. That enzyme is deficient. Now, clinically, these kids are like culture plates. They grow every organism. They grow bacteria, fungi, viruses, protozoa. If you got a bug and you want to grow it, get one of these kids. They will grow it. They're like a culture plate. They also get unusual infections like CMV, pneumocystis carinii. And you should never ever give these kids live attenuated vaccines. They'll get really, really sick. They don't have any immune system, basically. How do you treat these patients? Well, the treatment now is you got to replace the stem cells. So we usually use a compatible bone marrow stem cell transplant. If you've been reading the news, though, the latest, sexiest new treatment is going to be gene therapy, where we're actually inserting this gene, adenosine deaminase, into people. So keep your eyes open. That will be the wave of the future, but not for this exam. Okay, what's the prognosis? Well, almost all of these infants without treatment die within a year from one of these opportunistic infections. Very, very severe disease. Next one is called Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. This is an X-linked recessive inherited disease. And I want you to remember the classic clinical triad. These patients tend to develop recurrent infections. They tend to have decreased platelet levels, and they tend to develop a skin rash, eczema. That's the classic triad. Last thing I've seen them ask on the exam is that patients with Wiskott-Aldrich have an increased risk of developing lymphoma down the line. Okay, let's move on to secondary immune deficiency syndromes. And I want you to skip right over to C. Let's talk about acquired immunodeficiency. AIDS is going to be on this exam step one, step two, step three. It's incredibly important in the United States, in foreign countries, especially Africa, and the board recognizes it. They tend to ask a lot of questions about it. So you should know at least the definition. It's somebody who is HIV positive and has a CD4 count that is less than 200. Or they're HIV positive and have an indicator disease, AIDS-defining disease, like pneumocystis carinii. Let's look at the epidemiology. In the United States, it tends to affect males more than females because the first population in the United States who really got this disease was male homosexuals. Nowadays, who's getting it more and more? It's now the heterosexual population, especially heterosexual females. That's the highest risk group. Okay, it affects every age group, every ethnic group, every area of the country. Even the conservative South, they've got it too. How do you transmit HIV? Well, you should know about sexual contact. No doubt about it, anal intercourse is the highest risk way of transmitting this disease. And just to remind you, we're not only talking about homosexuals, they're not the only ones who have anal intercourse. Anybody who's ever watched Howard Stern knows about heterosexuals having anal intercourse as well. So remember, anal intercourse is the highest risk behavior for transmitting the disease. It can be transmitted by heterosexual vaginal intercourse. And a couple other things I want you to remember is cofactors. Herpes and syphilis are cofactors because they create breaks in the skin and allow the disease to be transmitted. Let's move on to parenchymal transmission. IV drug abusers. Male homosexual transmission is going down in the United States. IV drug abuse transmission is going up. That's the group that's increasing. Homophiliacs, since they're getting a lot of transfusions with products, they can develop this disease. And finally, hospital workers like you and I, we're at risk. We're going to take care of AIDS patients. Gotta be very careful when we handle needles. And finally, in the rest of the world outside of the United States, vertical transmission, especially in Africa, incredibly common, basically transmitting it to the unborn fetus. It's one of the torches diseases. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the virus itself. It's an enveloped RNA retrovirus. All good retroviruses contain what enzyme? Reverse transcriptase. What cell is infected? It's the CD4 cells. Any cell that's got CD4 on its surface can be infected. The big one are the CD4 T cells. Those are the ones that get knocked out. But I also want you to remember that other cells can contain CD4, especially macrophages. And macrophages actually will serve as the reservoir. It's where the virus can hide out from your immune system. Okay, so remember macrophages. Remember macrophages in the lymph nodes, they get a special name. We call them dendritic cells. Macrophages in the skin are called Langhans cells. Great places for the virus to hide out. Now, once the virus attaches to CD4, how is it going to attach there? It attaches with the glycoprotein 120. That's what's going to attach it to CD4. Now, for the virus to actually fuse and get inside, it's going to require the GP41 protein and two other co-receptors. They're the chemokine receptors, the beta chemokine receptor, CCR5, and the alpha chemokine receptor, CXCR4. How do you make the diagnosis of HIV? Well, this one should be rote. You do an HIV antibody ELISA test with confirmation by Western blot. How do you monitor patients? Well, we've been using CD4 counts to follow the disease, but the latest trend is now to use the viral load by PCR, and that's the best way to detect the level of disease. For treatment, the latest treatment is called the heart treatment. It's a triple therapy. We use reverse transcriptase inhibitors and protease inhibitors. It's like a cocktail of drugs. Okay, let's talk about the actual infection. Once you get exposed to HIV, 2 to 4 weeks after, you will develop a viremia. The virus will be easily detected in the blood. You'll develop a mononucleosis-like viral syndrome. You develop lymphadenopathy. The spleen can sometimes even be enlarged. That's the point where you start to seroconvert. The next phase is called the latent phase. This can be asymptomatic, or you can have persistence of the lymphadenopathy. The virus is still in your body. It's usually hiding out and slowly proliferating in the reservoir sites. Finally, you start to get minor opportunistic infections like oral candidiasis, herpes zoster, and then about 10, 12 years down the line, your immune system will finally be beaten down enough where you'll start to develop what's called AIDS. You'll start to develop the indicator diseases. And in your handout, there's a chart of the opportunistic infections that are commonly found within AIDS. Okay, a couple other things I want to bring to your attention is Kaposi sarcoma. It's one of the most common tumors associated with AIDS, very common in homosexual male population. Why? Because we think it's associated with the human herpes virus number 8. Okay. Now, where's the most common sites to develop Kaposi sarcoma? Well, first of all, it tends to be purple to red in color. It tends to be plaques or nodules. It could be on the skin. It loves the mucosal surfaces, so within the mouth, the GI system. The other place it likes to go is also in the lungs. And it can actually cause death, because if one of these blood vessels should rupture, they can actually exsanguinate into the lung. Okay, a couple other things to bring up is, AIDS patients have an increased risk of developing non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. And it tends to be the high-grade forms. Tend to be also occur within the CNS, tend to be lethal. Okay, I think that brings to the conclusion this chapter. We'll next move on to amyloidosis.